International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, EU ministers are looking at a controversial refugee plan with Turkey. President Obama is making history with a trip to Cuba. Blockchain technology might just be the next big thing on the internet.
Don't be put off by the term blockchain technology. Basically, what it is a ledger, a digital ledger.
And the Songwriters Hall of Fame is going to have new inductees. It's right here on The Voice of America. European Union leaders are expected to seal a final deal with Turkey on migrants at a two-day summit in Brussels today and Friday. Reporter Marissa Melton is joining us here in the studio. Welcome, Marissa.
Hi, thank you.
Say, what's on the agenda?
Well, we have on the agenda a controversial plan that would send tens of thousands of migrants back to Turkey from the European Union to relieve a strain on resources in the European Union, many of them close to the eastern edge, where the migrants are first entering. For every undocumented migrant that Turkey accepts, the EU says it will take one Syrian refugee who's been sheltering in Turkey, up to a total of about 70,000 refugees, and they will be resettled in Europe in a process that's overseen by the UN Refugee Agency.
Well, human rights groups are a little concerned about all this.
Yes. Turkey's standards for political asylum are a concern because they're not under EU standards, although the UN has had good things to say about their asylum standards in the past. More worrying is a recent crackdown on the media and other people who speak out against the government. There's also a violent conflict in Turkey with Turkish rebels called the PKK.
So what's the reward for Turkey in all this?
Well, if Turkey complies, it can have some. It can take some new steps toward EU membership, including, importantly, unrestricted travel for Turkish citizens inside Europe's border-free zone, which is called the Schengen zone. That doesn't sit well with France and several other European nations.
Okay, well, thank you very much for stopping by.
Thank you very much.
Iran's foreign minister has criticized Australia's policy towards asylum seekers. Mohammad Javad Zarif, during a visit to the country, also rejected continued scrutiny of Tehran's human rights record and its ballistic missile program. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Mohammad Javad Zarif is known for his forthright views. At the end of an official two-day visit to Australia, Iran's foreign minister again took aim at Israel and the United States for threatening to bomb what he called Iran's peaceful nuclear facilities. Zarif also tackled the contentious issue of human rights, just days after the United Nations reported on an extremely high rate of executions in Iran, especially for juvenile offenders. In an interview with Australian television, the foreign minister said while other countries were concerned about human rights in Iran, he too was worried about the treatment of asylum seekers detained in Australia.
We don't like some aspects of the way Australia treats Iranians who have been basically lied to by human smugglers who come to Australia. Well, the fact that they live in unconscionable situation.
Asylum seekers who try to reach Australia by boat are sent to migrant camps in the South Pacific, where conditions have been described by rights groups as inhumane. The government in Canberra insists that offshore processing of refugee claims has helped to stem a steady flow of asylum seekers risking their lives at sea. Zarif said the 9,000 Iranians who'd sought asylum in Australia were preyed upon by traffickers and propaganda from government sources. This week, Canberra has been trying to strike a deal with Iran to forcibly repatriate asylum seekers whose refugee claims are rejected in Australia. But opposition politicians have insisted that safeguards must be in place to ensure the safety of anyone who returns. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Time for a look at what's going on the web today. And social media reporter Andrew Palchevsky tells me it's a whale of a story. Sorry about that.
No, I like that. Andrew. That's good. I'm always up for a good pun. But it is the orca whales are actually trending because SeaWorld, which is the big aquatic life kind of amusement park here in the United States, has announced that it's no longer going to breed orca whales in captivity. Now,
that
this
has been very, very controversial for years.
Very controversial. And this is actually a story that kind of started out on social media. There was a documentary released a few years ago called Blackfish, and it talked about how SeaWorld was mistreating these whales and a lot of activists saying that this was terrible. They were being bred and kept in captivity. And so that story kind of grew on social media, and a lot of people targeting SeaWorld's social media, tweeting at them saying, you need to stop this. So after a couple of years of that going on, SeaWorld finally says, now times are changing and so are we. And so orca whales are trending. A lot of positive response on social media about this announcement saying, good for SeaWorld. This is a great step in the right direction. They're adapting to the times. And a lot of those animal rights activists, people who were involved with that documentary Blackfish, saying, we did it. This is a big victory for us.
I wonder what SeaWorld says about how much the social media influenced its decision.
I think it had a big impact because we were getting a lot of negative press, and a lot of that was coming from the social media reaction. A lot of times when there's a controversy like this, it can kind of be like a wildfire. It can grow out of control very quickly. And I think that was what happened with this. After this Blackfish documentary, they received a lot of negative attention. So I think that was a big part in influencing their decision.
You got anything else going on today? Quickly?
Yep. Other big story today? St. Patrick's Day. So happy St. Patrick's Day to everybody out there.
Everybody.
I hope you're wearing green. Neither Susan nor I are wearing green today. So as they say, you have to pinch people that don't wear green.
No.
We won't do that to each
Keep
other.
Keep your hands away from me.
No, lots of people, Irish pride throughout the world. Mm-hmm. Certainly in the U.S., a lot of Irish Americans, Irish heritage. And a lot of pictures of people wearing green, making soda bread, eating green foods. And a lot of people saying, well, I don't look good in green, so I'm just going to stay home today.
And people dyeing the rivers green, too.
In the city of Chicago, they dye the river green.
Okay, thank you so much, Andrew, and happy St. Patrick's Day.
Happy St. Patrick's Day.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
About 21% of world electricity generation is estimated to be from non-fossil fuels such as the wind or sun. But scientists hope to boost that number by looking at new ways to create it, one of which involves food waste. A team of researchers found that damaged or spoiled tomatoes can be turned into a unique and powerful source of renewable energy when fed to biological and microbial electrochemical cells. And the good news is, there seems to be a nearly endless supply of damaged and rotten tomatoes, since Florida alone generates 359,245 metric tons of tomato waste each year. The scientists admit that right now the power produced by their tomato-fueled energy cells is quite small. But they're quite optimistic that, with continued research, they'll be able to greatly increase the electrical output of their energy cells. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
President Obama makes history Sunday when he arrives on the communist-ruled island nation of Cuba, the first visit to Cuba by a sitting U.S. president in nearly 90 years. Obama administration officials say Mr. Obama will hold bilateral talks with his Cuban counterpart, Raul Castro, on Monday, meet with members of Cuban civil society, including human rights activists, and address the Cuban people Tuesday. Ted Henken, who will be in Cuba during the president's visit, has written extensively about Cuba and is an analyst at Baruch College in New York. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty the Obama visit is aimed at making the normalizing of relations begun in December 2014 irreversible. He also says it is an opportunity to speak directly to the Cuban people.
While it is true that the Cuban government has been very resistant to responding in a reciprocal manner to the United States' gestures and opening, I think that the Obama administration knew that, and they want to make this trip really to communicate with the Cuban people to remove the United States from the scene as the bete noire, the whipping boy, the scapegoat for all of Cuba's problems, and really communicate directly to the people that our policy is really built around empowerment, prosperity, not poverty, engagement, not isolation. And while we will and we are making diplomatic connections and strides with the government, we also intend to continue to respectfully and diplomatically but forcefully stand up for American values of human rights and democracy. But the president has made very clear at the same time that it is the Cuban people who should and who will decide their future, and the United States will not be making demands on anyone in Cuba, but will be communicating a message of friendship, of assistance, of solidarity, and also making clear that the policies of the past failed, and we are beginning a new path.
Will he be able to meet dissidents?
Yes, absolutely. And the Obama administration has been clear repeatedly that if Obama goes to Cuba, part of the deal is that he gets to talk with everybody, with who he chooses and not who the government wants him to meet with only.
Human Rights Watch has called on the president to call for concrete measures to end systemic repression in Cuba during this visit.
The strategy that has developed under Raul since he took over from Fidel roughly 10 years ago is that instead of typically sending people to prison for long terms for political crimes, people have been harassed, they've been detained systematically, and the numbers of detentions run around 8,000 detentions, short-term detentions a year. This is combined with attacks, mob attacks, beatings, harassment. So that's one of the things that they're pointing to. But also there's a whole gamut of fundamental freedoms, such as the freedom of assembly, the freedom of the press, that effectively don't exist in Cuba, although the Cuban people, in various guises, have been making great efforts to occupy new spaces over the last 5 years, and especially over the last year and 2 months. Given that the tension with the United States is waning, I think that people want to take advantage of the space of lowered tension so that it's not so easy to dismiss them as lackeys of a foreign power, as being controlled, as mercenaries, but as citizens who have diverse and often dissenting opinions that they want to share through the press, independent organizations, associations.
And Ted Hankins says he sees the trip as both significant and symbolic in legitimizing an independent civil society in Cuba that is not necessarily opposed to the government, but provides a credible alternative voice. After Cuba, Mr. Obama will travel to Argentina, the first bilateral visit in nearly 20 years. It is part of an ambitious year of travel throughout the Americas, taking the president to Canada for a North American Leadership Summit and to Peru for November's Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit. Coming up on International Edition, is there a grail for internet safety? And songwriters get recognized. For too many lately, the internet has become a scary space, somewhere that hackers steal your identity. Governments lurk and spy on your activities, and everything from your financial assets to your very reputation are vulnerable to theft and attack. But what if there were a way to both increase online security as well as bolster privacy? It's possible such a grail may exist. It's called blockchain technology. And it might just be the next big thing on the internet. Hmm. International Edition's Doug Bernard covers the cyber world for us, and he joins us here in the studio. Hi, Doug.
Hi, Susan.
Say, so Doug, just what is this all about?
Well, don't be put off by the term blockchain technology. Basically, what it is a ledger, a digital ledger. Now, for thousands of years, we've had ledgers where we recorded everything from transactions, purchases, inventories, legal records, that kind of thing. And they've served us very well. But in this new interconnected speed of light world that's run by the internet, actually, that's become really kind of slow. Humans are the slowest element in the chain right now. So blockchain technology is a way of collecting, assembling, distributing information, data that you would usually see in the form of a ledger, say, on somebody's desk or maybe on somebody's computer, but doing it in a decentralized way so everybody has access to the same information at exactly the same time.
So how does it work?
Here's where it gets a little complex, so I'll try and make it simple. It's highly mathematical, but essentially, imagine a place, whatever you're measuring. Let's say you're measuring purchases. So every hour, there's thousands and thousands of purchases. Well, periodically, every 10 minutes or so, the controlling computer system systems, which are decentralized, gather together all the latest transactions into what's called a block. And they're sent on to all the participants in this blockchain, all the people who want access to this information. Those people use this very mathematical formula, their computers do it, to verify the accuracy of all those transactions. They're bundled together in what's called a block. And then almost like a Lego, it sort of clips onto the very end of the last block. So it's block, 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 assemble, assemble, assemble. So you get a long chain. And the way it's constructed is that you can't alter a block once it's been part of the chain, and you can't move its place. Once it's there permanently, forever.
Well, you say permanent, but it seems to me we've heard that before.
Yes. Every time a new thing comes along, people like to tout it as the next greatest thing. So advocates of blockchain technology are saying, look, this technology creates permanent records, and often they'll use the word immutable records. There's truth to that in that the information in the chain before you can't be overwritten, like you could take an eraser to a paper ledger and erase it, but it can be amended. So it's still possible that bad information can get into the chain. And of course, once it's there, now, again, they'll say the mathematics of it make it unlikely. Well, unlikely is not a guarantee. So as always with the internet, there's no guarantee, but they are looking at this as a way to, I think, increase both transparency and, as they're saying, bolstering privacy.
So what about privacy and security?
So you would think that with all of this stuff out there, everybody has access to this chain and everybody can read it. Well, that's even less private. I mean, everything's just sort of out there in the open. Perhaps that's true. Very often these chains, these transactions, let's say I purchase something. Well, my purchase is recorded. The date and the time and the place of it's recorded. But my identity is not. So identities can be shielded really kind of pretty much forever. What they're looking at, I think, are ways to take this technology, which is really came about with Bitcoin, and find other ways to apply it in other industries.
Okay, well, thank you very much for stopping by.
You bet.
This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? It's called the Kaleidotorch, torch made by the R-Cube company. It's a flashlight and a tabletop lamp, a lamp that emits an ambient light, good for when the house lights go out, good for use as a night light or a work light that doesn't invade other spaces. Adjust the brightness by moving the sleeve on this device up or down. The R-Cube company says the Kaleidotorch gives off enough light to help you read by. But it looks like reading could be a bit of a chore if the Kaleidotorch is your only light source. It certainly works as a mood light with its soft ambient glow. Reviews of the Kaleidotorch, as any Google search will demonstrate, have been almost all good. The Kaleidotorch runs on three AAA batteries and comes in a variety of colors. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grosshans.
Pop music lovers may be very familiar with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, Ohio, but there is another equally prestigious shrine in New York, which is about to open its doors to new inductees, as we hear from Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald and VOA's Jim Stevenson.
We're going to be talking about the Songwriters Hall of Fame. That's pretty exciting.
Well, I attended the opening of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland back in 1995, and that's when people talk about music halls of fame, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame sort of springs to mind. Mm-hmm. But the Songwriters Hall of Fame has actually been around longer. It's been around since 1969. Songwriters Hall of Fame has a long and distinguished history, and they announced their 2016 inductees, who are Elvis Costello, Marvin Gaye, Tom Petty, the team of Nile Rodgers and Bernard Edwards, and Chip Taylor. And we'll take them one at a time.
All right,
Elvis, let's go. Costello came in during the height of the punk rock movement, but he quickly proved himself much more versatile and wide-ranging than that. He's been making records since 1977. He has worked with Paul McCartney. He's worked with String Quartet. He'd recently released his memoirs. He's a very erudite man, and he's getting recognition as one of the premier songwriters of the modern era. Marvin Gaye was Motown royalty in the 1960s, and he later left Motown for CBS. Tragically, he was shot by his own father in 1984. Tom Petty has been one of America's leading rock and rollers since the mid-1970s, both as a member of the Heartbreakers and as a member of the Traveling Wilburys and as a solo artist. Nile Rodgers and Bernard Edwards were the masterminds behind the disco-funk band Chic, which proved very, very influential in the late 1970s. And Nile was a huge producer in the 1980s, and he recently resurfaced a few years ago with Pharrell in the hit single Get Lucky. Nile is still very much active. And then there's Chip Taylor. Now, back in the 1960s, Chip wrote two of the biggest hit singles of the past half century, Wild Thing, made famous by the Troggs, and Angel of the Morning by Merrily Rush. And you can't, I can't think of two songs that were more different, but that shows his versatility. And his songs have been covered by everyone from Aretha Franklin to Johnny Cash. These songwriters are receiving their recognition at the 47th Annual Induction Dinner. It takes place at the Marriott Marquis Hotel in New York City on June 9th. And a press release said additional special award honorees will be announced soon.
Starting in the late 60s, my goodness, that was a time when songwriting was really big for a lot of artists.
It was a premium on innovation and risk-taking. And that's why you see so many great songwriters growing out of that era. But, of course, there are great songwriters and producers working right now. And as time passes, we'll probably see them coming into the Songwriters Hall of Fame as well, because one of the activities of the Hall is to nurture up-and-coming songwriters.
Prominent in our own Hall of Fame is our VOA Top 20 Countdown host, Ray McDonald. He's also very prominent on Twitter, too. Follow him.
Ray on the hits.
Thanks
Drop
so much.
By, say hi.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Ray.
You got it, Jim.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at VOA_IE. And for more news, visit voanews.com. Thanks for joining us for International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The strength of a nation depends on the success of all of its people. So any country hoping to grow and flourish must recognize the important contributions of women from all backgrounds and enable them to succeed in their work. Latin America has come a long way over the past two decades. Women serve in elected office, including as heads of state. They run businesses, large and small. They study and they teach. Yet they still face many obstacles. Perhaps most appalling is the widespread violence against women in the Americas, said U.S. Undersecretary for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights, Sarah Sewell. Noting that between 17% and 53% of all women in Latin America have been victims of physical or sexual violence inflicted by their partners, Undersecretary Sewell said that many Latin American countries rank among the worst in the world for the number of women killed each year. To prevent violence against women, we must address imbalances in education, employment, and politics that reinforce a culture where women are valued less than men, where they are somehow seen as less worthy of equal respect, opportunity, and protection. Women who have suffered violence must have a clear pathway to justice, a system that consistently enforces the law and ensures a fair and responsive judicial process. The U.S. government works to prevent and respond to violence against women, integrate a gender perspective into our work, especially to prevent and respond to gender-based violence. In 2012, the United States developed a global strategy to tackle all forms of gender-based violence, which affects all countries around the world, including the United States. In Latin America, we assist indigenous and African descendant women to participate in local government and advocate against violence and discrimination. We train women entrepreneurs to reach new markets, and we partner with local law enforcement to train more female police officers, prosecutors, and judges. We do this not only because gender equality is inherently worthwhile, said Undersecretary Sewell. When you broaden participation and emphasize inclusion in business, in arts and culture, in politics, it enriches us all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.